The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.
This is the Fixer Sciatica Podcast.
Throughout my years as a physical therapist and working with patients with sciatica pain, I have come across these folks who are actually getting prescribed gabapentin, which is often a pharmaceutical or drug that gets prescribed commonly. And the other day, I was just really interested in just learning a little bit more about why this is helping or how does this help or if it does help. And I had the opportunity to come across some really interesting research. But rather than me just trying to extrapolate this information as a physical therapist, I have someone who is well-versed in just the chemical pathways of pharmaceuticals interviewing Dr. Bailey Schroeder, who's a pharmacist herself. So Dr. Bailey, so great to see you.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to chat about gabapentin today.
Yeah, and the honor is all mine. You were really kind enough to do a couple episodes in the past talking about various different medications. And I said, oh, I think that you'd probably be the best person to talk to in regards to this medication. So before we get into it, for the listeners who might have met you for the first time, tell us a little bit more about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, so I am a pharmacist. I've got my PharmD from South Dakota State University, and I graduated in 2020. I am a community pharmacist. So I work in a little independent pharmacy, and we have some cool services. Not only do we just dispense medications, as you would expect, but we have some blood pressure programs, diabetes programs, and offer some unique services there. I also have my own practice where I do consulting. It's mainly focused on pharmacogenomics, so how your unique DNA impacts your response to medications. But in that, just some personalized services there because people deserve some one-on-one attention with their medication. So I do that as well.
Very cool. We'll talk a little bit more about that pharmacogenomics because it's certainly a growing field. And 100%, everyone's biology is different and our chemical makeups are different. And it would make sense that each one of us would react differently to medications. And so I'm glad that you were able to take that on. For the listeners out there who aren't quite familiar with pharmacists, tell us a little bit more about the primary role of pharmacists in healthcare.
Yeah, most people are probably familiar with the pharmacist where they pick up their medications, whether it's in a grocery store or a standalone pharmacy. So while we do dispense medications, and that's a big part of our role, we do a lot more. So many of us conduct screenings. We can screen you for prediabetes with an A1C test. We can do cholesterol testing. We can test your blood sugars, your blood pressure. So we do screenings and have a lot of health events. That way, we're one of the biggest pushers for immunizations, and we really took on a big role during COVID and immunizing people to protect them and others around them. But we also are huge resources just for medical information. And so that's kind of why I'm here. I love to share information on medications. It's kind of a foreign concept to a lot of people, whether that's patients or doctors or anyone. You always interact with medications in your daily life or someone around you does. So it's helpful to learn from the medication experts.
It's awesome. I highly value your profession because some of the listeners might have heard this before. And I think we actually gone through this story when we first met or our first recording where I had about in 2021, I had a pretty intense allergic reaction to something. And I was in Florida at the time, and I went to go get some medications that were prescribed by the doctor. Now, I was going through a whole bunch of steroids prior to this allergic reaction, so I wasn't able to take steroids. So I took a high dose antihistamine and then was prescribed, I think it was Pepcid AC, which was a really good emergency anti-allergy medication. And what was interesting was that as I was picking this stuff up from the pharmacy, the pharmacist was looking and saying, hey, did you deal with an allergic reaction? And it was so interesting because they looked at the medications I had and working backwards into why I needed it in the first place. And then all of a sudden they suggested, oh, it's probably because you're allergic to the mangoes here. And it was such a cool experience. I was really touched by that. And it was like a really large it was like a CVS pharmacy, which I found to be particularly useful because of the fact that I know that the majority of the patients who are listening to this episode, I know that the majority of people, when they go see their doctor, they're probably spending about, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, maybe 15 minutes, if any, with their physician. And they're given a diagnosis and they're not really quite sure why they need the medications or how to navigate it all. Because when you're going to the doctor, you're already not in a good spot. You're dealing with something. And whenever they're delivering the news or delivering the action steps, it's a lot of information to take in. And so I really appreciate your role as a pharmacist to be able to be that other medical that other source of information, because we can go to Dr. Google and we can learn about all the terrible different side effects and all the different things that can happen with medications. And I think in a way, you as a profession have a very good background in understanding the chemical pathways, and really just reassuring us, or kind of re-identifying like things that we need to consider when it comes to medications, which is why we're here today, right? So that's a long-winded way of me saying thank you for what you do. And moving forward, tell us a little bit more about gabapentin. It's a common medication that is prescribed in sciatica pain management.
Yeah, it is very common. In fact, I looked back all the way to 2019, so it's consistently in the top 10 medications prescribed. I see it so much, and very, very rarely do I see it for what it's actually approved for. So gabapentin is an anticonvulsant, and it's only got approval for seizures and postherpetic neuralgia, which is a complication of shingles. And most people are very surprised to hear that, because I honestly haven't seen it for either one of those. I mostly see it for nerve pain associated with diabetes or sciatic pain. I see it for mood. It's got a whole lot of what we call off-label uses. It's very common.
How does it work? Because I think, number one, there's a lot of different medications, right? We talked about NSAIDs. I think that was the first episode that we talked about, and we were talking about the, I think we were talking about the SSNRIs as well. We haven't gone over this specific class of medication. So what class of medication is it? And yeah, tell us a little bit more about how it works.
Yeah, so it is an anticonvulsant, and then it is further categorized. It's a GABA drug. So when I say gabapentin, I'm just going to group gabapentin and pregabalin together. Pregabalin is very similar to it, or Lyrica, if you're familiar with that name. So anything that I say about gabapentin pretty much applies to Lyrica in this case. But the shorter answer is we have no idea how it works. We know that it freely passes the blood-brain barrier, and it affects neurotransmitters there. And we know that's where the pain signals come from. You know, it comes from your brain and travels down. So they do have some affinity for calcium channels. And what happens with their interaction with calcium channels is it inhibits the release of the excitatory neurotransmitters. And the thought is that decreases pain perception. So it does not address the actual source of pain, but it addresses your perception of the pain.
This episode is brought to you by the Patient Advocate Program. Are you tired of not having support between your rehab sessions? Introducing the Patient Advocate Program, and we're focused on your recovery, and we're offering you 24/7 access to a doctorate of physical therapy. Stop waiting in line to be seen and stop spending hours doing long exercise programs. Imagine being able to get all of your care delivered straight to your phone. Best of all, it's affordable. We believe everyone deserves top-notch relief without breaking the bank. So why wait? Take control of your health today and visit PTPatientAdvocate.com and book your free call with our experts. Okay, yeah, let's take a deep unpacking of that, and I'll share with you my experience as a physical therapist. So, listeners, as you may have known, there's many different pathways of pain, and so those pathways of pain include what we call like the gate control theory, which this is all mostly based on theory. They haven't been 100% proven, hence why they're called theories versus actual facts. But really the idea is that there's multiple pathways of pain. One is going to be the gate control theory. So what that means is going to be what we're looking at. You have, I think there are four. So you have neuropathic pain, which is actually pain originating at the nerves. You have the gate control theory. So what that means is you injure a body part. So like you injure your sciatic nerve, and then there's literally chemicals that get released during periods of injury. Then the chemicals released during periods of injury is to focus on enhancing inflammation, which inflammation will lead to healing. But in those cases, when there's inflammation, it's going to be sending a painful stimulus to your brain. So it's going to be from injured site to your nerves, and it travels up. The gate control theory is actually going to be limiting and stopping it right at the level of the spinal cord. So what that means is that the pain signal can't get through your spinal cord, it can't transmit up to your brain. The other area is going to be the chemical pathways that actually occur. So we have the inflammatory process. So when you injure something, there, again, there's inflammation focusing on healing. Inflammation also results in swelling, which also causes pain as well. So that's why when you're having stuff like anti-inflammatories, you're going to be reducing the said inflammation, hence taking the pressure off the nerves. Another aspect that often gets overlooked when it comes to pain processing is what we call the central sensitization. So once that pain actually goes from your injury site up through your spinal cord and transitions into your brain actually has to determine whether or not that pain signal is actually a danger signal, which again, that's what pain is. It's going to be a signal that there is something that is going on. It's going to cause pain, which is going to result in you changing your behaviors to stop doing said behavior, or just a normal brain signal, like the sensation of touch. And so based on what Dr. Bailey was sharing with us, especially if it looks at working more so at the blood-brain barrier, it's going to, I guess, theoretically change how your brain actually perceives this signal. So maybe instead of a painful threat, the brain is actually going to be interpreting it as just a normal electrical chemical stimulus. I'm going to stop saying signal because I've said that multiple times in this segment. But a large part is really, I really appreciate you saying that it's changing the perception, which again, pain is an experience and it's something identified by you yourself. And unfortunately, it's an invisible metric. And because it's an invisible metric, it's hard for us as practitioners to be able to get a clear idea in regards to what can we do to help this out. So I do appreciate, Bailey, that you said it actually doesn't address the actual source of pain. It really, the idea is that it affects more so the end point where your brain actually starts to register it.
Right.
Is that about right? Yeah.
Yes. And this is one of the reasons why I really don't like this medication. I just don't like it, because if you don't address the cause, then you're just putting a Band-Aid on it. And medications are not benign. They have side effects and they cost money, and you can create this prescribing cascade. And so I don't like them. And we can go into why, because there's a lot of misperceptions about pharmacists that we push for medications and that we love medications and we want you to be on lots. But really, since we're the medication experts and we've read the studies and we know the data, I can tell you this is not a good option.
Yeah, it's before we get into that, can we just take a little bit of just a little time talking about taking a little bit of a deeper dive into the mechanism? You said it actually crosses the blood-brain barrier. For the listeners who may have heard that term for the first time, can you tell us a little bit more about like what that is or what that looks like in regards to the transition? Or what's even better is if you could share with us like the typical pathway of once we swallow a pill, mm-hmm. What's that process like?
Yeah, it all depends. I would say medications, we can start with the blood-brain barrier, actually, that will help. So there is a semi-permeable, basically, gate between your blood system and your brain. Your brain doesn't actually have blood vessels. It's its own organ. But some medications are able to cross and some are not. The ones that cross that gate into your brain are the ones that are going to cause what we call CNS effects. So it can cause dizziness, drowsiness. They can have a risk of developing tolerance or misuse. So there's a lot more safety concerns when we have drugs that cross the blood-brain barrier, because we worry about its effect on the brain. We're really familiar with opioids and their ability to, they actually tell your brain it forgets to breathe. And we call that respiratory depression. So it turns off the sensor in your brain that tells you to keep breathing. So we have a lot of concerns with medications that cross that, but there's ways to go about them safely. So when you take a pill, it goes into your system, and then usually most of them will get into your bloodstream and they will act throughout your body. There are ones that are targeted and they, based on their structure, know to work only, for example, let's go with omeprazole. You can take it, it works in the stomach, it knows to, it teaches it to decrease less acid, and then you have heartburn relief. But some medications are not so selective. And when they're not so selective, they have more side effects as well. And yeah, like we talked about, like NSAIDs, anti-inflammatories, some of them are more selective. They know where to work. And then they end up having less side effects too.
So especially when something like gabapentin, it looks like it has the FDA approval for seizures and post-herpetic neuralgia. So from my understanding and the way that I see it is that, especially when it comes to like a seizure or seizure.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
All medications require eligibility and prescription. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month med plus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
For disorders, it looks like it ends up being like a random firing of the brain, or like the post-herpetic neuralgia, which what ends up being what we call central sensitization. It's like the brain is on high alert in regards to trying to protect itself from whatever painful stimulus there are, or lack thereof. And so it kind of focuses on trying to reduce the hyperactivity or the activity of the brain to calm, in essence, what I like to call to calm the storm. And especially when you are taking something like gabapentin, it would address kind of like the whole brain, because it would actually cross that threshold. And I appreciate you sharing, like, when you take a medication, it usually kind of addresses the whole body, and that there are a few that are a little bit more selective. So let's talk a little bit more about like the dosage, what people would often be presented with in regards to, from like a pain management standpoint.
Mm-hmm. So what I see most commonly, almost always, I see a 300 milligrams three times a day. And I am probably a more cautious pharmacist, and I think it's probably better to start with like 100 three times a day, or only at night. So my concern with it is it can cause pretty significant drowsiness. So especially for someone, if they're older, if they are frail, if they are on other medications that can make them drowsy, I would feel more comfortable with 100 milligrams. 300 is fine, but certainly not starting with three times a day. It's important to taper up, mainly for tolerance. So starting with a dose at bedtime to make sure that one goes well. I educate people to start at bedtime, and then the next dose, if they want to try one in the morning, make sure that they're not driving somewhere and that they're at home to monitor how they're doing. And some people can really do fine with it. It has a huge dosing range. It can go up to like 1200 three times a day. So that is a benefit, is If you're not seeing benefit at 300, you've got plenty of room to go up, but it's important to go up safely to make sure that you are able to function appropriately in your day-to-day life. I would say 100 or 300 at bedtime is appropriate, and then working up to three times a day.
I'm so intrigued. You brought up this concept of you having some, say, concerns. It's like, okay, it's going to be pretty, it's because it acts on the central nervous system, it's going to lead to drowsiness. And you often see like a pretty big dosage, 300 milligrams, three times a day. Do you communicate that concern with the patient as you're dispensing the medications? Or is this something where we're looking into like education with the clinical team? Behind that, I'm so intrigued. I know that I communicate with physicians either through my notes or sometimes I'll give the physicians a call. But yeah, I wonder what the dynamic is like for you as a pharmacist.
It's a very fine line because I like to be respectful of providers, and I understand that what has been discussed in the office isn't communicated to me. However, I have in my mind, if I have a concern with a dose or duration, et cetera, plus another backup reason. For example, if I had an 85-year-old, she's also on cyclobenzaprine, which is a muscle relaxer. She's also on hydrocodone every day for another reason. And now we're adding gabapentin. Now I've got three reasons. And in that case, I would call. Other times, if I have patients that I know that they have a good understanding of their medications and they have the ability to maybe follow directions a little bit better and have more of a medical background or have the capabilities to follow directions that I would suggest, then I would not bother the provider in that case. It's still following what they write if they write 300 three times a day, but you know, it's within our discretion to say one at bedtime for 3 days and work your way up to what the provider wrote. I think that is perfectly acceptable. So it really depends on my level of comfort with each individual prescription.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I really appreciate you presenting these cases because oftentimes when people get their prescriptions, say from their doctor, and they go to the pharmacist, and then they go and they kind of just take it blindly or have questions, but don't really know that they can turn to their pharmacist to get a little bit more clarification on that. And I really appreciate the work that you do. Yeah, so this makes a ton of sense. And again, I'm appreciative of all the work that you do. When it comes to medications and also the use of it and the effectiveness, I'm always intrigued to see what the research shows, because ultimately a lot of times our recommendations, whether it be through physical therapy or even in medicine, are based on the general guidelines or whatever the research has shown and dictated. So let's take a little bit of a dive into the research behind this medication for sciatic pain. Through my research and getting myself prepared for this episode, I actually came across two articles, one that was back in 2008 saying that it's a potential option for treatment, and then in 2022, where it's a systematic review on the effectiveness of gabapentin for sciatica pain. Throughout your research and as you've come across it, what did you gather from that research, from those articles that I had the opportunity to send over to you?
Yeah, I really like systematic reviews because they do have criteria. They aren't just picking any random study, but they have a criteria of studies to include. And then it's a nice brief overview to look at what is the overall consensus currently. So this one, it looked at eight different studies, and it looked at some gabapentin, some pregabalin for sciatic pain, and different outcomes. So leg pain, disability, so your ability to do your everyday activities. And the results weren't great. There was only one out of the eight that had statistically significant differences in relief of pain at 3 months. And that's, I mean, one out of eight is not great. So each individual study looked at a few different things. One did have a difference in leg pain, like I mentioned, and that did start at 2 weeks. So that's a good indicator that, you know, you could get benefit quickly. But if you go beyond that, 2 weeks, 8 weeks, they even went out to 52 weeks, and there wasn't significant differences in pain and disability for most of the studies that they looked at.
Yeah, and that's particularly interesting because here you have this research, yet this medication is actually getting prescribed pretty often. So I'm always just so intrigued as to why that's the case. And I think now I'm not a physician, obviously, so I'm always just so intrigued to just trying to get a better understanding as to what the thought process is for the medical community to prescribe medications such as this. And I'm sure that they each have their reasons. I think from my end, what this tells me is to, when it comes to seeing information like this, to be able to communicate with your doctor and identify, well, is this medication going to be for me? Or what are the other options? Or what's the effectiveness like? I know that, and I find this statement intriguing because every time people say, you know, I don't like taking pills. I think the majority of us don't enjoy taking pills to begin with. And so to be able to ensure that we're getting ourselves in a position that actually addresses the issue or has to be some sort of effectiveness as well is going to be key. So yeah, it was really interesting. Listeners, if you want to get a link to that article that both Bailey and I have been talking about, I'm actually going to be putting it into the show notes today. And it's a fairly recent study in 2022, so it's pretty new. And what's interesting, and I don't know if you know, Bailey, the length of time it takes for these articles to get published. I know that systematic reviews do take some time. For me, when I was in grad school, it took a whole year actually to create a systematic review. And that was with me and like four other students. And we didn't really know what we were doing. But I know that to get them published in various different medical journals, it can certainly take some time. So data has probably been out there for a while, but it's definitely something that, something that we can certainly look into. It gives us an opportunity to figure out, you know, are these medications for us? Now, aside from side effects, Bailey, are there any other considerations that we need to look into before considering something like gabapentin?
Yeah, so we talked about the dizziness, drowsiness. Some people do get some nausea from it as well. Considerations would be age, also other medications that they are on. So if they're on other, like we said, blood-brain barrier crossing medications, that would be something to consider. Since it does cause the dizziness, drowsiness, caution with alcohol and other things that can impair cognition. And I did actually, there was a very recent study that showed an increased risk of COPD exacerbations with people on gabapentin because of that respiratory depression risk, hypothetically. So something to consider with that. And then any kidney impairment, reduced kidney function, it would be important just to be cautious of that and start low and go slow.
Absolutely. So Bailey, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a really cool learning experience. And I got an opportunity to learn a little bit more about this medication. And listeners, again, this is just information to give you an opportunity to figure out with your doctor if these medications are for you. And it's going to be important that you communicate with your team to figure out what the best options are for you. So,
and do want to add really quickly, I think we were, you know, talking about why would prescribers even choose this in the first place. I do want to say that they do a good job of treating your pain, that it's real and that it deserves treatment. And I don't want to say that this medication shouldn't be started, but it shouldn't stay on your med list and be escalated and then parked there and never addressed again. I think you absolutely deserve treatment for your pain and deserve to try things and everything, you know, comes with its own risks. And so I think they do a good job of addressing and wanting to give you multiple options to try and get you some relief. But the concern is escalating the dose, parking it there, and leaving it for years and years, and then you get side effects.
100%. And so communicate with your doctors, communicate with your pharmacists throughout your entire pain journey. Communication is going to be the most important because, number one, we can't do our jobs if we don't know what's going on. And so if something's working, awesome, let's run with that. If something isn't working, definitely speak up. I think it's challenging, especially in how fast the medical world moves or how fast the world moves, that you might not necessarily feel like you have the opportunity to communicate the effectiveness or lack thereof with your medical team. So definitely advocate for yourself. Let them know whether things are working or not, because I've said this in multiple episodes, pain is invisible. It's an experience that you're going through. And although we can actually measure your level of function, is going to be different compared to how you feel. And if we can get those to match, and if we can improve them through many different ways, that just gets you one step closer to having the quality of life that you deserve. And so people like Dr. Bailey, your local pharmacist, being able to communicate with them and your physical therapist and absolutely your doctor is going to be key to ensuring that you are going to have the best team behind you. Speaking of team, right? And speaking of medications and what could be the best options, tell us a little bit more about your role in your consulting as in pharmacogenomics.
Yeah, I love this field. It is growing, it is changing, it is so interesting. And I really envision 5 to 10 years from now, it will be more of a standard of care. So everyone is different, everyone is unique, and medication is not a one size fits all. And what I can do is order a test. It's a simple cheek swab, and we send it to a lab, and they come back with specifically information on how your DNA affects medications. I do not deal with cancer risk or ancestry DNA. It's just medications, but this information will apply for the rest of your life. So even if you're not on medications right now or ones that are affected by pharmacogenomics, it is so key for guiding your physician for prescribing for the rest of your life. So I love to do that. It's just such a great way to ensure medication safety and save you money and time in the future. And even if you're not interested in the whole pharmacogenomics piece, I love to sit down and talk about medications, because your 15-minute annual checkup, you talk about often other important problems, and the medications don't get the time that they deserve, but they deserve the time and they deserve the review. So I love to sit down and just address whatever issues people have and see how we can simplify it and make it better and make it as best as it can be for your health.
Awesome. And for the listeners who want to get in touch with you, what is the best way?
Yeah, my website, it's just getinformed.com. It's getinformed.com. Or if you are super trendy, I am also on Instagram at getinformed.
Awesome. Listeners, if you did not get a chance to write that down, I'm going to go ahead and put the show notes in addition to the research articles that we have been referencing today. Dr. Bailey, it was so great seeing you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was always awesome to talk about meds and health with you.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you got some help from today's podcast. And for more info, check us out at ifixyoursciatica.com. Have a fantastic and pain-free day.
No patient-therapist relationship is formed by listening to this podcast. We are not providing medical advice, and all information should be confirmed by a medical provider.